students. Hints on studying and how to develop what's called an information sorter. And the keys to studying the metabolic pathways are to organize, understand, condense, and then finally the last thing will be memorized. So the more organizing, understanding, and condensing, then you'll minimize the material that needs to be memorized. If the diagrams don't work for you, you can draw your own. Use ones that have meaning. And as always, we're going to sort out the trivia from the pathways, the stuff that's not overly important. You can read these points on an information sorter, and if you want to develop one, that's up to you. It's entirely up to you how you study, but these are suggestions of things that you would put in some kind of table, and then you can fill them in for each pathway. So we'll have glycolysis, gluconeogenesis, pentose, phosphate, glycogen, synthesis, breakdown, and then finally electron transport. So if you had one of these sorters for each of those pathways, you could basically make a table and answer the 13 questions. So that again is just a suggestion if you want to use that as a way of studying the pathways. Because starting Monday we'll be getting into the first pathway, which is glucose, galactose, fructose conversion to pyruvate, also known as glycolysis. So before we do that, we're going to do some more introductory material and in particular talk a lot about energy today. And basically, there's some terms that we need to know before we get started that are metabolic terms that we'll be using. The first two are anabolism and catabolism. You may see those written. And anabolism generally refers to something being synthesized, so that's a synthetic process. And catabolism, which often is called metabolism, is a degradative process. So often you'll see catabolism and metabolism used interchangeably. There's going to be a committed step in each pathway that's going to be the first unique reaction in a pathway that we will always point out. We'll say this is the first committed step, the committed step in the pathway. And then there's always going to be one that's rate limiting. And the enzyme for that reaction will be particularly important. And it'll be one that we point out and talk about. And that'll be the slowest reaction in the pathway. So that enzyme, that particular reaction, will determine the rate of the whole pathway. And all of the things that we'll be talking about will be in what's called a steady state. And we're always talking about things being in equilibrium, basically. Everything going, flowing from reactants to products, and everything remaining pretty much constant unless there's some sort of perturbation. And we'll talk about examples where something might happen to either speed up, slow down, different things that can happen in the metabolic pathways. So that first picture is really a kind of complicated looking thing, but really it can be simplified, and again, if it just looks out there, you don't have to really focus on it. And basically all it is showing is things go in and things come out, and so as we look at metabolism, that's generally what will be happening. Something will enter a pathway and something will come out the other side. A lot of the reactants that enter will be things that are nutrients for cells, and they will use them to get energy primarily. And then of course cells, as they go through all these things inside the circle, going from big to small molecules, and phosphate groups come on and off and so on, and then they make some sort of waste. And usually we'll be watching carbons and wondering, where does the carbon go? Where does it end up? How is it then degraded? Anything that comes out the other side. So it's basically just a really general picture of things go in, things come out, which we're all pretty aware of. So the types of regulation we're going to see in all of these various pathways, we will see pretty much an example of each of the types of regulation. The most common type that we will see is basically your Michaelis-Menten kinetics, Lineweaver-Burk plot. So you've got your maximum rate, you've got your Km, which is basically a measure of the enzyme's affinity for its substrate, or mathematically, the amount of substrate needed to give half of the maximum rate. And the most common type of regulation will simply be substrate availability. So basically, is there substrate available? If yes, then the reaction proceeds. If no, then it doesn't. And when substrate concentrations get right at or just below the Km, then the reaction tends to be very sensitive to very slight changes in concentration, and a lot of these reactions will be that way. So most things are kept in a very kind of tight, constant equilibrium and are sensitive to very small changes, perturbations in concentration. So we're talking about very small numbers of all of these things, very low concentrations, nanos, picos, small. Another type of regulation is called allosterism. You know, we need this thing to be here at 11. This is like the third day.
It's only 11 at 4.
Okay, but it needs to be here. So allosterism then is again a concept of something happening at a site that's not the active site. And so if this is a little example of an enzyme, then this will be the active site. Say the molecule comes, substrate binds, reaction occurs, product leaves. This may be an allosteric site, and we will see a number of different enzymes where something that binds in the allosteric site, and a lot of times it's phosphate, so you see a phosphate group there, and it can be stimulatory or inhibitory. So some things binding allosterically actually stimulate an enzyme, and some things binding allosterically inhibit it. So we will see cases of both. Molecules binding that stimulate and molecules that bind that inhibit. Again, here's another kind of complicated picture for the very simple concept, and one again that we're going to see a lot of, and that's feedback inhibition. So all those arrows are trying to display to you feedback inhibition. And basically what that means is the product that's generated in a reaction then goes back and regulates the enzyme that catalyzes that reaction. So the product is actually the regulator. So when we get too much product, that slows the enzyme down. So that's going to be a very, very simple and common type of regulation. Again, the picture is fairly complex, but all these products are basically going back on the reaction, back to the enzyme to inhibit it or slow it down. And by inhibit, we generally mean slow down. So all of these processes, none of them really stop and start completely. Everything is just either going a bit faster or a bit slower. So we're talking about speeding up, slowing down. Then covalent modifications, which we talked quite a bit about earlier in the course. There's a number of them that can happen. And again, they can be stimulatory or inhibitory. And the most common one that we will see, and we will see it over and over again, is phosphorylation. Lots and lots of enzymes are phosphorylated, which again, in some cases, for some enzymes, it inhibits them, stops them from being active, and in some cases it stimulates them and makes them active. So we're going to see examples of that. A rather uncommon form of regulation, and I don't remember if we see it in this course. I know there is one enzyme next semester, and that's polymerization. So there are some enzymes, and again fairly rare, where you have a number of subunits that have to associate together, come together, for the enzyme to be a polymer, for it to be active. And then when they come apart or dissociate, the enzyme is inactive. And I don't remember if we see one enzyme that has that type of regulation or not, but we definitely see one next semester. Here again is our regulatory proteins, regulatory subunits, which again is a concept we're coming back to again, we will see. And basically, the concept there is you have a big protein that has two pieces to it, a C or catalytic piece and an R or regulatory piece. And when everything's put together, when the pieces of the puzzle are all in place and the enzyme is one whole unit, then it is inactive. Then something happens, some kind of signal, and something binds to the enzyme and that causes those pieces to come apart. So like pieces in the puzzle, we take them apart. At that point then, the catalytic part, the C part of the enzyme, becomes active and actually catalyzes changing reactants into products or substrate into products. Regulatory unit just sits there waiting. Then when whatever the signal was dissociates and leaves, the pieces come back together and the protein again becomes inactive. So it's different than zymogens or proenzymes. There we cut off a piece and that piece never comes back. It's basically degraded, goes into the amino acid pools that we have in our body for synthesizing endogenous proteins. So in this case, though, the pieces stay and they come apart, together, apart, together, apart, together, based on signals. And often the signals are second messengers, which we won't talk about too much this semester. Then you've got induction, which we can go all the way to the genetic level as a form of regulation. Again, not as quite as common as some of the other types. And of course, there you have initiation of transcription, Or you have, of course, the opposite process, repression, which is inhibition of the synthesis of the protein. So we're going back, we're inducing, going all the way back to a genetic level, DNA, RNA, all that we talked about, and transcription going on, or then inhibiting that. And overall, the balance between the two of what we call induction and repression is called turnover. So you have things being made and things being broken down. So you've got synthesis and degradation. So from our amino acid pools, we have some K synthesis that makes proteins, hence enzymes, and then we have a degradation process that puts those amino acids back into the pools. So that's endogenous. Endogenous means within the body protein synthesis. And that's a form of regulation. It can go all the way back to the genetic level. Again, not as common. Primarily, we're going to see feedback regulation. Very simple, very effective. So the product itself will go back and regulate the enzyme from which it came. Translocation, that's another form of regulation. Can things get in and out across membranes? So plasma membranes, cell membranes, and also intracellular and extracellular. So transport is another form of regulation. Sometimes when concentrations get too high, things are just stopped from coming in. When they get too high inside, they're forced back out. So another form of regulation is just simply things getting to and fro across the membranes. So again, regulation is going to be key because, again, when we're talking about biochemistry, we like everything to be or stay really in a very kind of tight equilibrium situation. So just like pHs and just like body temperature, everything is pretty narrow and stays in a narrow concentration range. Now this picture, it's not important that you know all of the metabolic pathways because this is an expanded picture of the picture we saw on Monday, which I did say was particularly important that you know those pathways because those happen to be all of the ones that we'll be discussing the rest of the semester, which was glycolysis, gluconeogenesis, pentose, phosphate, glycogenesis, glycogenolysis, the TCA cycle, the citric acid cycle, and electron transport. This gives you even more, so this takes the really big picture of all the metabolic pathways. So now you've got the protein pathways, you've got esterification, urogenesis, ketone formations, and you've got the fat pathways, so how we make and also we break down fats to use as energy. But what is very important in this picture is the things that are in squares, the things that are in circles, and again, the three key intermediates, so the ones with all the arrows poking out from them. So first looking at the ones that are in squares and in your legend called the three energy storage forms. And those are glycogen, which remember is the storage form for carbohydrates, proteins, the storage form for amino acids, and triglycerides, remember how we store our free fatty acids. The circulating fuels, so the things that our cells can use for energy, are glucose, lactate, amino acids, free fatty acids, and ketones. So those are key. Those are the fuels that cells use for energy. Glucose, lactate, amino acids, free fatty acids, and ketones. And which cells can use which ones, we talked just a tiny bit about, and we'll emphasize that more as we go along. Again, the red blood cells being very simple, just use glucose, don't do a lot of different pathways. The brain, huge user of glucose, can use ketones equally well. And we'll again talk about different tissues as we look at the pathways. And again, the key intermediates, the ones with all the arrows, glucose-6-phosphate, pretty much a big intermediate, goes pretty much everywhere, pyruvate and acetyl-CoA. So glucose-6-phosphate, pyruvate, and acetyl-CoA, and we're going to talk in detail about the fates of those three things. And you notice just glancing at the picture, they're involved in a lot of the different pathways, and they connect a lot of the pathways. So this is a little bit bigger picture than the one we saw Monday, and there's still even bigger pictures that will cover basically a whole wall of all of the different metabolic processes. So energy. The reason we're even talking about metabolism is energy. So we need to talk about how the body, how cells actually get energy, how is it transferred around. And most of the energy in the body that the cells get and that we use is the complete oxidation of acetyl-CoA to become ATP. And basically here we're talking about the citric acid cycle. It is the major energy producer. And as we go through the pathways, we're going to start with the sugars, glucose, galactose, and fructose, and we're going to take them down to pyruvate. Then on the next day, we'll see how pyruvate is converted into acetyl-CoA, and then we'll take that acetyl-CoA into the citric acid cycle, go through the steps, see what happens to it. In the citric acid cycle, we're going to produce a lot of ATP, which we're going to talk about now, We're also going to produce a lot of NADH and FADH2, which will then lead us into the electron transport chain sitting along the inner mitochondrial membrane, where we will take the NADH and the FADH2 and then convert it to even more ATP. So thermodynamics, of course we need energy. This is for locomotion, for biosynthesis, everything. And in most mammal cells, it is produced via oxidative metabolism. So we have oxygen involved. Some very big exceptions, red blood cells again. Very simple creatures, no mitochondria, anaerobic basically. Skeletal muscle, when you're on the treadmill or running or jogging or whatever, going undergoing high intensity exercise, goes into an anaerobic state. And plants, of course, which we're not really studying, don't derive their energy from any of these things, but from photosynthesis. So high energy phosphate bonds are kind of our key, and I don't have an overhead of ATP, but you can all see it there. There's ATP. That's our biggest carrier of free energy. We're actually going to see a couple of compounds that have even more energy than ATP, but ATP is the biggest, most used carrier of free energy. Where does it carry it? It carries it in those phosphate bonds. So you see them labeled alpha, beta, gamma. The ones we want to focus on are beta and gamma. Beta and gamma. The alpha phosphate is basically never cleaved off of ATP. So we go from ATP to ADP and from ADP to AMP. But we don't have really anything that is just ribose and adenine. We may, but it's not something we're going to be concerned with. So AMP will be the smallest that will go. So between the gamma and the beta, the furthest one out, if we lop off that last phosphate, that gamma phosphate, we get 7.3 kcals of energy. We take the next one too, leaving us with AMP, so we cleave off the one between the beta and the gamma, we get ADP. Take off the next one, leaving us with AMP, we get minus 6.6. So all together from one ATP, we get 13.9 kcals of energy. So we've got to add those two together, 13.9 kcals of energy. There are, interestingly, one compound at least that gives us more energy. Here is how muscle gets energy, and this is an example, and you do not need to memorize these structures. Remember, I mentioned on Monday, this exam will be without structures for those of you who fear them, so you will see them again in the next semester, but at least for this exam, you don't have to worry about them. So here's phosphocreatine becoming creatine. Those of you, again, into bodybuilding and so on know about phosphocreatine. And this is the way muscles, particularly muscles undergoing high-intensity exercise, also weightlifting, any phase where you're getting into anaerobic-type exercise, is they basically take this compound called phosphocreatine, which you see here, and they make creatine. What's the difference between phosphocreatine and creatine? The phosphate group. So notice ADP becomes phosphorylated and becomes ATP. So basically what the muscle is doing is producing ATP, which we now know is energy. So this is the source for muscles. And so that means phosphocreatine basically provides 10.3 kcals of energy. And again, primarily important in muscles. Another compound that's very high energy that we actually see in the glycolytic pathway, so we're going to see this guy, is 1,3-bisphosphoglycerate. 1,3-bisphosphoglycerate. And this guy provides 11.8 kcals of energy. And we're going to see as we go through the glycolytic pathway on Monday that this reaction provides a lot of energy and actually pushes the pathway along, gives it a boost of energy, and gives a little bit of energy to a couple of reactions in the pathway that are actually endergonic, so that are not exothermic. So this is a high-energy compound that will be important to keeping the glycolytic pathway going. Again, the way we derive the energy is we're going to see these phosphate groups coming off, and that's where the energy is stored. Now notice the last intermediate, and this one we will also see in the glycolytic pathway, has more energy than ATP. And this is phosphoenolpyruvate. It's going to be an intermediate way down almost at the bottom of the pathway. From it, we'll go to pyruvate. And notice when we take off that high-energy phosphate group, we get 14.8 kcals. So that's actually more than ATP. Though ATP is our key energy molecule because most cells, mammal cells particularly, derive energy from ATP. So these are all called high-energy phosphate compounds. Those are all high-energy phosphate bonds. And again, that's the way we get energy for locomotion, clearly for biosynthesis, which we will see many examples. It drives a number of endergonic reactions, and any place basically in the body where we need energy, we're going to see ATP. We're also going to see NADH and FADH too, and we'll talk about those as we move along, because they can become ATP in the electron transport chain. Just a note, and it's not particularly important, but in the body, usually in enzymes at the active site, so you know we have this big protein, which we call an enzyme, it has an active site where the substrate binds, there will be ATP, ADP, AMP in some cases. Usually those phosphates are complexed with some kind of metal, and it's usually manganese or magnesium. So as you keep a kind of picture, for those of you who visualize this stuff particularly well, there'll usually be a complex there, so the ATP and ADP and AMP don't really sit completely alone. But again, not overly important, and you don't have to draw that or draw ATP. So there's a couple of types of phosphorylation that we're going to see. The most common one that we'll see the most of is called substrate level phosphorylation. And that's basically going to involve moving a phosphate group from one of these high energy phosphate compounds onto another molecule. So transferring phosphate groups, substrate level phosphorylation. That's how most of our ATP is made, substrate level phosphorylation. Now there's also oxidative phosphorylation, and we're going to see that the very last day, last new material, electron transport. And that's basically a reduction of oxygen to water in the mitochondria. And it requires electrons and electron carriers. That's where the NADH and the FADH2 are going to come in. So NADH and FADH2 are converted to ATP via oxidative phosphorylation, also known as the electron transport chain. And we will see that in the mitochondria in the very last thing we talk about. Now, the next thing is a picture. Again, this is one of those, toss it if you don't like it, but basically it's showing you kind of an overall diagram, and if you like diagrams and really can really follow them well, then it's good for you. If not, then okay. But you've got there your phosphoenolpyruvate, you've got your 1,3-bisphosphoglycerate, high energy phosphate compounds, succinyl-CoA we will see as a compound, you've got oxidative phosphorylation giving you ATP, all of that giving you high-energy phosphate groups, which become ultimately ATP, and primarily in the citric acid cycle, which is round cycle. For muscle, it's the creatine story. And basically the ATP then, that phosphate that between the gamma and the beta, and between the beta and the alpha, produce many, many, many things that cells need to survive. So it's just kind of showing the flow of phosphate coming from high energy compounds and from electron carriers going through becoming ATP and then ending up as a number of different products. So other phosphorylations occur. We have a lot of activations, deactivations. Glycerol-3-phosphate, glucose-6-phosphate is made. Remember, that's a key intermediate in all the different pathways, even fat and protein pathways. Glucose-1,6-bisphosphate. So basically the ATP then gives its energy to produce many other things. So again, it's kind of a big picture. The phosphate comes in, goes into certain cycles, particularly the citric acid cycle, which we'll look at in detail, and we end up then with energy to produce a lot of different compounds that are needed in different organelles and cell types. And that's really the last picture. So as a quick review of thermodynamics, and then one last concept that's of really particular importance. Again, review oxidants, reductants. We're going to see NADH and FADH2 a lot in these pathways. We're going to see them wherever we see a dehydrogenase enzyme. And I hinted at that when we started talking about enzymes, and I'll bring it up again. Anytime you're going to see something that's a dehydrogenase, lactate dehydrogenase, pyruvate dehydrogenase, any of those, you're going to see NADH and FADH2, which are electron carriers, as we talked about. They're going to be important, again, because they're going to provide energy. Not directly. They have to go into the electron transport chain. But once those electrons fall into that chain, and we're going to see them bounce along the chain, they will drive a pump that will produce ATP. So they're going to be important in energy production, which is the whole kind of key. Free energy, then, as definition, which you've seen in general chemistry, is the portion of the energy in the system that's available for us to actually do something. For locomotion, for biosynthesis, etc. The change in free energy then we call delta G, And delta G is equal to a standard free energy constant, which is something you would look up in a book. And in general chemistry books, they have tables of standard free energy constants. And it's equal to that plus 2.3 RT, R constant, T temperature, the log of the concentration of the products over the reactants. And what's most important for biochemists is delta G negative or is it positive? Because, of course, we're looking for delta G to be negative for reactions to be exergonic, exothermic, or spontaneous. And, again, most of the reactions, and particularly the first reactions, the key reactions, the regulated reactions, and all these pathways will be exergonic. They will have negative delta Gs. We will actually look at the delta Gs for a number of the reactions, and we will see a couple of endergonic, positive delta G, non-spontaneous reactions, but they're always going to be coupled to some reaction that is highly, highly exothermic that actually drives that reaction so we can get past it. Because the key is, of course, all these pathways, for instance, glycolysis going from glucose, fructose, galactose to pyruvate, they have to be able to go. You don't want anything to be inhibiting the pathway. Otherwise, we won't get energy. It won't be conducive to life if we can't take the sugars and actually metabolize them and get energy. So remembering, first of all, that the standard free energy can still lead to a negative delta G. And as we look at overall pathways, we have to sum all of the delta Gs for every reaction. And overall, the pathway will be negative. And that's what's important. Remember Le Chatelier concentrations decreasing and increasing. And basically, Le Chatelier keeps things in equilibrium. So if you take something from the right side of the equation, it pushes back left. Take something from the left, it pushes back right. And kind of stays in a kind of general equilibrium state. And there's a little bit, again, the kinetics there of equilibrium. Again, the key, though, the concept for us is no net flux, primarily in either direction, is an equilibrium condition. Now, more important than those things is the last bit here, and it's an enzyme called adenylate kinase. It's also called myokinase. You may have heard it used interchangeably, depends what books you look at, literature. Adenylate kinase, myokinase. Going to come up again and again and again. This is a key reaction, the one you see here, as a metabolic regulator. So you see a reaction of ATP plus AMP going to two ADPs. And an example of this reaction being useful is given when you're doing, again, high-intensity exercise, so you're on a treadmill. You're using a lot of energy, so you're obviously using a lot of ATP. So ATP is screaming over and becoming ADP. Well, of course, the muscle then is trying very hard to go back and phosphorylate that ADP to give you more ATP. And so you've got a mass action effect going on. And notice you're getting two ADPs for every one ATP. So it's pushing as hard as it can. And that makes sense. But what's more important is what happens to that little AMP that's here in the reaction. And basically what happens to the AMP is increases and decreases in AMP, but most importantly increases. So as you're intensely exercising, you're using ATP, making ADP, and your body's trying to push back the other way, you're making and increasing the amount of AMP that you have a lot. And AMP is a key allosteric regulator. We're going to see it over and over and over again. It is really a key symbol or signal or regulator in cells that tells the cell that there is a low energy state going on, that we need to increase metabolism through alternate pathways, through any pathway that the cell has available, and again, depending on the cell type, which metabolic pathways it has available to it, to make energy. So for instance, in red blood cells, that would simply mean glycolysis, because that's all they can do without mitochondria, is metabolize glucose, fructose, galactose, to pyruvate, etc. So again, AMP is the key, not so much the numbers, but as AMP levels increase, it's a key signal to a cell that energy is decreasing, and we need to do something to kind of activate the pathways and get them going to produce more energy, give more ATP. Otherwise, things will stop and break down. We won't be able to continue, for instance, the intense exercise that is an example given.